Yes.
Brady?
Here.
Christensen?
Thank you, Sherry.
Lout?
Here.
Snell?
Here.
Absent are Begay, Beanstalk, Brownstein, and German.
Thank you, Sherry. Agenda item number 2, review, discussion, and possible action on committee meeting minutes. I'll make a motion that we approve the open session minutes from November 1st.
I'll second.
Motion and a second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed. Meeting motion carries, none opposed. Sherry, you had your hand up. Did you need to say something?
I just saw that Ali just joined us right when we said he wasn't here, but he is here.
Oh, great. Ali, are you here with us?
Yep, I'm here.
Great. That's a big help for our quorum. Okay, agenda item number 3, notice of proposed rulemaking. Is Jessica here with us? Jessica, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Great. Thank you for being here. I just saw Dr. Brownstein joined as well. Can you hear us, Dr. Brownstein?
I can hear you. Yep.
Well, great. Glad you're here.
See that. Thank you.
Jessica, why don't you go ahead and get us rolling?
All right. Give me 1 second and I'll share my screen. Okay, and this is where we left off.
Dr. Lout.
Yeah, at the end of the last meeting, I and Dr. Snell had talked about revising this 1303 section. So we made some changes since the last time we talked. Dr. Snell was nice enough to meet with me, and we revised it so it flows smoother, knocked out some of the things that there was questions about, and this is what we came up with.
Great. We appreciate you guys spending the time working on this. Dr. Lout, do you want to walk us through some of what you did?
Yeah, okay, I'll go through it. Section C there, we basically, at the end of the document or end of this section, there was some discussion from old that was changed a long time ago. We more or less took that part out, and this is what we've got now, Section C, as far as the Board Approved Graduate Postgraduate Education. And we added pharmacology that was not there before.
Ryan, if at any point as we're working through this, you see something you want to comment as board staff, maybe if there's any stumbling blocks or concerns you have, just speak up as well.
So I guess if we can go down the document a little bit, Jessica.
Sure.
Made some changes just regarding oral sedation, just put moderate sedation, interim moderate sedation.
I think we can move past these comments. I was just noting who had made the suggestion, changes their language.
The changes in there from me were just the reference sections. So depending on where we go in this meeting, I'll probably go back to referencing what's lined out with the R411-1306.
So, one, thanks for the work there, Dr. Lau and Dr. Snell. And I really like the changes you made in terms of readability and flow and continuity. But I'm, again, maybe it's in a previous section. We've just been going on for so long, I forget. This deals with someone who's completed a graduate or a postgraduate education program and the same person who is coming in from, a different state with a sedation permit.
Correct.
And an applicant who completed training in intro moderate sedation more than 3 years before. So this does deal with someone who does not have a postgraduate program. It's just a general dentist who went out and got his own training, right? It applies to them as well.
Yes.
This applies to any dental professional who's initially applying for a 1303 permit, regardless of what they've done beforehand.
And we get that because Section 2 says an applicant who completed training in interim moderate sedation more than 3 years. Last round, it only says more than 3 years. I mean, because in Section 1 is successfully completed a board-recognized graduate or postgraduate education. So that's someone who's a specialist, right? But Section 2 should apply to both specialist and non-specialist. And it says more than 3 years before submitting the permit applicant. It doesn't define the individual who has not completed a training program is my concern.
Can we move up on that, Jessica?
So to Randy's point, I think successfully, this is the way I read it, maybe it needs to be more specific. If successfully complete board recognized graduate or postgraduate education, that is not necessarily a residency program. That could be a program, and I'm just going to name it, such as DOCS. That's an education course that's provided for someone to take to get the 30 hours that they need in order to apply for this permit. It does not have to be a GPR or an oral surgery residency or anything like that. It's just education.
Okay. If that's how that is intended to read, I'm all for it. I think then that answers my question. And I think that's fine as long as we're all in agreement that that is the definition of postgraduate education, meaning beyond dentistry, not necessarily specialist, but a program like DOCS, like you're describing. And if that's the case, I'm fine with it.
Okay. I think we can go back down now, Jessica.
Can I ask one more just clarifying question on C2? So it's up a little bit, I think, Jessica. Oh, I guess that has it. So are we saying that they could either have completed a course and signed an affidavit, or have a certificate from another state or military training and sign an affidavit, or they have to do all three?
Let's look at it again.
Well, it says applicants shall meet one of the following.
Where?
Under letter C. So I read it as though applicants that are applying for this permit shall either have successfully completed a board recognized graduate or postgraduate education or training in enteral moderate sedation more than 3 years, and then it goes and it lists out the criteria for that.
I guess maybe that's, so they can't just sign an affidavit and get a permit.
Heath, go ahead.
So I think when Dr. Lott and myself were writing this, what I was thinking is you got two scenarios. One, someone that's coming out of a course, an education course right away, and they want to apply for the 1303. Someone else that has taken a course, has been practicing in another state doing oral moderate sedation, enteral moderate sedation, but now they're coming to Arizona, and the course was done more than 3 years ago. So they wouldn't fall under category number one. So then they would be able to do it under category number two. They would have to show that they've been doing cases, which is why we have the numbers of patients there. And we would want to see a copy of their permit from their other state where they're coming from or the military. So that would be, so basically A, B, and C would be needed just to show that if the course has been more than 3 years, we know that they've been doing cases during that past time and they're showing a permit that they already have that permit from another state or the military, wherever else they've been practicing.
So where would someone fit in? Sorry for dragging this out. I want to make sure that the language as I'm understanding it, like, reflects what the intent is. So what if you had somebody who hasn't done sedation in more than 3 years or maybe ever and wants to get a 1303?
So I would say they'd need to fall under
from another state, but they could do the training course of A and then sign the affidavit of C and get their permit, right?
I would say they would fall under item number one. They would need to complete the affidavit and send in the course.
Oh, so they'd have to go back to one to do it. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. That's back to continuity of care and competency that we had talked about early on in the preparing this document.
Got it. Thanks.
Ryan, go ahead.
So just a quick question. Related to these pathways. So like C1, C2 are pathways, and then 3 has been removed. And then we added 4. So is there 3 pathways and 4 would become 3, which is the pediatric endorsement, or should 4 become?
No, I think 3 is the part that we deleted and redid it in the top under 1.
Yeah.
So I guess the pediatric would now be 4, Ryan. Or no, I'm sorry. The pediatric would now be 3.
So there would be 3 pathways, or should we make pediatric endorsement B, or with some of the similarities of C? I'm just... because it kind of doesn't fit now, but I don't know what your thoughts are. And I'm not an anesthesiologist again, so I'm actually relying on you if it should have its own category or should it be part as a third pathway.
Dr. Snell, and then Jessica, you know, as a rule writer, you may want to comment on Ryan's question. But go ahead, Heath.
Just if we're trying to be consistent, the 1302, the pediatric endorsement is kind of its own main heading. So it would be like, you know, a letter D instead of a pathway, as Ryan's talking about. We'd make the pediatric endorsement, everything about it is its own section for a 1303 pediatric endorsement and outline exactly what is entailed to receive that pediatric endorsement and to continue to have that pediatric endorsement. That's the way it is in 1302. It's 1302. I don't know where it's at, but it was its own thing.
Yeah, I agree with Dr. Blazek. He just stated that making its own item. But Jessica, do you have a comment on that?
I do not. I think that that's consistent. We had the pediatric endorsement as its own section within each of the permit rules. This is Jessica. I do have some questions and comments, though, on this language. When you're talking about providing proof of 30 hours, is that just an affidavit that they are submitting saying that they have completed those 30 hours? Or are you looking for something from the institution? And then secondly, what does board recognize mean?
I think we had stated it later on, but I can see what you're saying up there. I think everything else we've done in all of our applications and everything has been affidavit. So I would probably stick with affidavit. I think that reads pretty well.
And then my second question was board recognized. I know we've struggled with that language in the previous section, just because if you have in there board recognized, then you're looking at the board to provide a list essentially of recognized graduate or postgraduate education. And then you're also kind of opening it up for courses or schools or institutions that provide that graduate or postgraduate education to figure out how they can become recognized by the board.
Ryan, do you have a comment on that?
Only the same comment. I'm not a huge fan of board recognized because it almost puts staff in a weird position that everything that comes in has to go to the board because we're not keeping lists of stuff that's board recognized versus what isn't. It probably should mimic, And the thing that's really scary is the legislature several years ago passed laws that says if you're licensed somewhere, you can come here as long as you were licensed for a year, not practicing, just licensed. And so those other states have different requirements just to get a license, period. And so their board recognition may be different than this board recognition. So I don't know. I mean, the only other way to get around it is the proof should come from a school as opposed to an affidavit. But I don't know if you guys want to make it that complicated.
Well, and I guess what my thought is, I'm not aware that we as the board recognize any type of education or not. I mean, outside of licensing, you know, initial applicants for practice, but not for continuing education. So I don't know how that really fits. Dr. Snell.
I was just going to say, in writing that, I just took the verbiage that we've already gone over and I think is still in there under 1302E, which is for initial applicants of 1302. It says successfully complete board recognized undergraduate, graduate, or postgraduate education within 3 years. Not that I'm defending that it needs to be board recognized, but
this is pointing to a bigger problem of a lack of good recognition, lack of recognition of good CE versus questionable CE. But I think that's outside the board's purview right now.
I have a quick question. How does the board identify courses that are that qualify for CE? I mean, period, right? Like I take ADA, it's continuing education. I take PA, education. How does the board recognize that? Isn't it the same idea? And it's off the topic, but it's kind of the same thing.
Sherry?
Actually, there is a definition that is board recognized CE. So I was just going, scroll right back up, Jessica. Right there, it says recognize continuing dental education. So that is what the definition of recognized CE, and that's what we look at.
It's super broad. Most courses are, I'll say, in general terms, accepted simply because it's pretty broad. But when you go to Jessica's point, you almost have to define what board recognized is if you're going to put it in there. And to Dr. Hero's point, I'm not a huge fan of the board recognized because the board, I don't know, isn't like a credentialing agency to state whether or not it's acceptable or not. So I'm not a huge fan of board recognized. I think it's kind of default language that the legislature over the course of several years, dating way before some of us are even born, were just writing into statutes or rules just to get through a process.
Jessica.
So if this is the standard that's already been defined, recognized continuing dental education, instead of belaboring whether or not we should use board recognized, what if we just use the definition that's already there and say that you have to show 30 hours in recognized continuing dental education, which has already been defined?
So just add continuing education to board recognized?
Correct.
Okay.
So 30 hours of and then you can eliminate graduate or postgraduate. So it would look like that.
Looks great.
Jessica, Dr. Blazek asked if we can mimic the pediatric endorsement language from 1301 and 1302 in this section.
From 1302?
Yeah, section O right there. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it doesn't have to be as, you know, with all the extra providers and stuff, because it's an oral as opposed to, or it's a, I know in section 02, we place a lot of other requirements.
Backing up a little bit, we're comfortable with all of the changes in number 2.
Yes.
Okay, and we're still comfortable getting rid of number 3?
I believe so.
Yep.
Okay, that brings us to new number 4, I believe. Pediatric endorsement applicants who have not completed a postdoctoral residency program must sign an affidavit confirming completion of 60 hours of training in pediatric airway anatomy, physical evaluation, medical conditions, pharmacology, sedation, medical emergencies, as well as 25 cases in patients less than 8 years of age.
Dr. Brady?
I just have to step away at this moment. And do we still have a quorum?
We do. We've got, I think, 8 people right now.
Okay. I'll be back. Thank you.
Thank you. Dr. Caputo.
I'm curious if any of the current committee members either are aware or can provide comment for a dentist who's looking to satisfy 4, particularly with the number of cases and the age identification. Are there currently any courses out there that do this? And B, if there are no courses, then how do we address that we effectively cut off a pathway for a general dentist who's interested in providing this level of sedation for this age group that effectively couldn't satisfy this because the training doesn't exist?
I would have to say probably the only comment I have related to that, Dr. Caputo, is this age restriction that we've placed in here as well as in the other permit holder locations is strongly driven by the white paper from the American Association of Pediatrics and Pediatric Dentistry, where they kind of got on board about how to redefine the definition of anesthesia to pediatric patients. So hence, that's where all of this pediatric designation is coming from, is to try to show some type of semblance that we're identifying this patient population that maybe needs some extra training before you put them to sleep. That would be my comment about that. As far as other courses out there specifically related to this, I am unaware of any.
Dr. Caputo.
So I guess that's my point. I mean, it would seem to me there's somewhat of a difference in maybe the amount of training one receives and how that correlates to actual patient treatment. The two are not inclusive and actually can be exclusive of each other, particularly with enteral sedation. The point being is, if there's no course that exists to do this, then you've effectively cut off a pathway for dentists to be able to do this for their patients. So I'm just wondering if there is an understanding that the pathway's been significantly impacted for dentists, whereby it's not so much a matter of training anymore, it's a matter of practicality and opportunity.
Dr. Lau, at your pedodontic association meetings, I'd imagine they offer oral sedation courses.
We do. We have a course of about 25 hours. I think Docs has a pediatric dental course that they do as well. So the hours are out there. You just got to look for them.
Thank you, Dr. Lau. Does that help, Dr. Caputo?
No. Not asking about the hours. It says, if I'm reading for correctly, even though I don't see it anymore, I think it said something about 25 patients age 8 or younger that the person has to have experience in. And I'm not aware that Docs offers that, and I'm not aware of any AAPD courses that offer that, as well as any other courses that offer that. But I think that was the comment there. Like I said, it's not on the screen anymore, but if I read for correctly, it said 25 patients in addition to the 60 clock hours. So even to Dr. Lout's point, they offer 25. So they're not even halfway there. So, as long as I'm not going to belabor my previous points about there's really not a lot of support for 60 clock hours, but regardless, I'm trying to wrap my head around how you're asking someone to see 25 patients on top of that 60 clock hours when I'm not sure that that training even exists currently.
And Dr. Caputo, are you particularly thinking about the general dentist that's trying to get this pediatric endorsement that?
That's the only group it applies to. Because it's already addressed earlier for those who are residency trained. I'm just wondering if I know that there was a comment being written. I guess it's now in the comments section, but it says 25 cases in patients less than 8 years of age. So where is that going to come from if it doesn't exist? And how are you going to get that, especially with that age group? I'm not sure how well that was thought through in terms of at least even being achievable.
Well, to what Dr. Blazek said earlier, our Academy of Pediatric Dentistry guidelines has made some recommendations of children less than eight years of age. Consulting with Dr. German, who's a pediatric anesthesiologist, we just thought this would be an appropriate amount of hours and cases to show competency and able to give a sedation to kids less than 8 years of age. 8 years of age is from our documents as well, the pediatric dental documents. We just basically thought that you're going to need a little extra training if you're going to treat young kids. And this is kind of the consensus in other states too, Texas, California, I think Mississippi as well. So I think this is just related to this population, this young children that I think you need a little bit more training on.
Well, I mean, this is not a little bit more training. This is quite significantly a lot more training. Number one, you're doubling the hours, which again, I'm not going to belabor that point, but I'm still trying to wrap my head around in all the research that you're pointing to and all the documentation that you're pointing to. Is there anything identified out there that a general dentist can get that type of clinical exposure? And if it's there, I mean, how many courses are out there? And what sort of time is being involved here? I have to imagine a case is going to be in the range of at least a half an hour, if not an hour. I mean, half hour just to see drug onset. So you're talking about an hour. So you're talking about 25 hours at least of clinical exposure I don't know what courses are being offered. And that's sort of my question in the beginning is, I think it's one thing to put the requirement out there, but you have to at least have a pathway available. You can't just throw it out there and say, hey, good luck.
Well,
at least I don't think that's our intention. That's not about safety anymore, you know?
Well, we can also consider, like we've done with 1301, 1302, observing somebody with the same permit doing the procedure, like watching a pediatric dentist do sedations, things like that. You know, I think that would probably make it easier for some people.
Well, I think then that should be in there. At least I think what happens, because this has come up previously when I've gone through this training with dentists, is really understanding what that provision requires. And I think it'd be also helpful for board staff to be able to interpret this as well when these applications are being made. But I think there maybe should be some clarification of what that 25 case exposure should look like, whether it's the actual performance of the case or if observation is acceptable. And I'm fine with observation. That seems a little more doable, but
okay.
I guess I don't know. Even 25 cases of observation seems to be a lot. I mean, I could understand 10. But I don't know how you're going to – I don't know where the 25 comes from. And I don't know if you referenced the AAPD. Do they have research on this, that there's some magic about 25 versus 10 versus even 5? I mean, where does this number come from? It seems arbitrary.
Dr. Caputo, if I could just say just for a second, this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan, and then I'll butt out of your conversation. But – we are talking a lot about right now about the minimum standard and best practice and possibly, you know, standard practice. And always to remember that the board regulates the minimum standards. And if we do start to employ certain requirements that are above and beyond the standard or the threshold, that we then create appealable issues. And not only that, we create a position where the board has a hard time enforcing its statutes because they don't necessarily line up with the community standard. And I'll just say that and then step out. Thank you.
Yeah, it's sort of to my point, and I appreciate that additional information. I think this is well beyond what a minimal standard would be. And I just think that needs to be thought through a little bit. I can make the case for IV and the intricacies and the nuance of doing IV sedation. Enteral is just so much different. And I get the safety thing. Gosh darn it. I applaud every effort, being made here regarding safety. But boy, we just seem to have really exploded on this requirement for the general dentist that's really, it to some point, almost excessive. So that's what I'm trying to get my head around. Thank you.
Jessica?
Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you now.
Okay. So I just had a question on how number 4 is different than what was already required in C3.
Anthony.
Jessica, I'm having trouble hearing you.
Oh, okay. Is this any better?
A little bit.
Okay. So my question was, how is number 4 different than C3? C3 seems to be talking about how a dentist can either get or renew a pediatric endorsement if they don't have the residency program aspect.
Yeah, We lost you, Jessica.
I think, Jessica, she's talking about C3 there, Anthony, which I don't see C3 on. Oh, she's on a completely different section for the 1303 pediatric endorsement. She's moved past where we were under letter C, I think.
Actually, I moved forward or backward.
Yeah, sorry, moved forward. So, yeah.
So here's 1303. We have the initial A, B, and C is where we put in how to obtain a pediatric endorsement. One of the ways to obtain that pediatric endorsement or to renew the endorsement is submitting the affidavit showing that they've done 20 pediatric patients within 2 years immediately preceding Dennis' application. And this is if they can't meet number two, which talks about the residency program. So I'm wondering what's different between this three, C3, and what we're trying to get at in four.
Well, to be consistent, we probably should. We're requesting 20 pediatric patients in the 1301 and 1302. So I would think that we should stick with 20 cases instead of 25 cases. I think that's probably good.
So if we keep C3, do we even need C4?
I don't think you need number four because it's already been outlined under C3. And I also think we're number C should be like letter E where we're working now, Jessica.
Okay. And do you want me to move that section, the pediatric endorsement section? Do you want me to move it for 1302 and 1301 as well?
I thought this, oh, you mean in the yellow?
No, so here, let me do this.
No, that's just for moderate oral, or interoral moderate sedation.
Okay, so what I can do is...
Dr. Brady's back with us.
Basically, I just swapped those. So now we've got the requirements to obtain a Section 1303 permit as subsection C. And then following that is going to be subsection D, which is to obtain or renew a pediatric endorsement for a Section 1303 permit.
Dr. Caputo, you got your hand up.
Yeah. I understand the idea of consistency, but one of the things that we've recognized, which I fully appreciate and embrace that this board has done, is that there is a difference between enteral sedation approach versus an IV sedation approach. There are nuances to starting and establishing an IV, understanding the equipment and supplies that are involved with the establishment of IV access, what kind of fluids to administer, what kind of gauge of catheter to use. There are so many aspects of IV sedation, either at the moderate, deep, or general anesthesia levels, that are significantly different than enteral. Enteral, you're administering a dose of drug to a patient, and specifically with pediatrics, you're administering a single enteral dose of medications to a patient, and that's it. There's no special training that's involved. There's nothing that's required to administer that drug other than to appropriately draw it up and give it either to the patient or the patient's parent to allow them to ingest it. That's it. Done. I get 20 cases for some type of intravenous or other route, intramuscular, sublingual, which are also parenteral, which also is vastly different than enteral. Enteral, there's one route of administration, oral. You give it to the patient, they either drink it or they don't. It's the end of it. We just trained ourselves in enteral sedation. I can't see how you can say from a consistency standpoint that 20 cases of enteral sedation is equivalent to 20 cases of IV or other parenteral administration approaches. And that's my point. I think we can do this and achieve the same thing from a safety perspective by recognizing a very different route of administration. So I embrace the committee's continued support of this route of administration, which I do think is important. I just think you can get there and still have a measure of safety incorporated by doing it at a more I think 10 is a very appropriate number of observational cases for that new person. And I think that's a better place. And I think evidence out there would support that. Because honestly, I'm not aware of evidence that says there's some magic thing about 20 cases, to be quite honest, other than maybe what's written in some standard somewhere. But again, I don't think the evidence is out there, and the research that I have done hasn't demonstrated that. And that's kind of what I'm trying to get at. Thank you.
Dr. Snell.
So to Anthony's point, a couple things. I would really like moving forward if we could bring back a section of the agenda for public comments. I think it would be helpful, and those that are here, which we appreciate the public being here, they would feel free to speak their mind during that section, and we can take what they have into account and then move forward. Second of all, I think there is differences between enteral and parenteral routes. I could teach someone how to start IVs fairly quickly. I don't think it's super nuanced. And the issue becomes the level of sedation. In my mind, it always will be the level of sedation, because that's what dictates the more likelihood for respiratory depression, cardiovascular depression, all those things that cause poor outcomes. So I think we can't look past that. And then as far as the numbers of cases go, I could argue the same thing for enteral sedation, parenteral sedation, general anesthesia. Has there been any research ever that shows cases? I don't know if there has been, but there's been published reports and recommendations from agencies that give numbers, and I think that's where we're using these numbers from.
Dr. Lout, then Dr. Brownstein.
Yeah, the reason we selected 20 is continuity of care that shows that you're doing it. That you're experienced doing it. I think 20 is pretty rational. If you're going to do kids, you know, you got to have experience in it. You got to show that you're doing it. You got to show continuity. So I kind of disagree with you, Anthony, on that one.
Dr. Brownstein.
Sorry. I agree with Dr. Lout. One thing we have to keep in mind is that we don't want to lower the case numbers, excuse me, so far that it's just a fraction of what a specialist is required to do in order to become certified to do enteral sedation. I know the AEPD has a specific number of cases that are required by a pediatric dental resident in order to become certified to do that. We don't want to make it 10 for a general dentist to become certified to do this, but make it 30 or whatever the number is for an AAPD certified resident. So we have to definitely keep that in mind.
I think we should also talk about where these cases are coming from for the general dentist, because Dr. Caputo did bring up a good point about not putting the board in the precarious position of trying to implement a rule or statute that there's no pathway for the licensee to go down. Dr. Blazek, you had your hand up.
I withdrew it. I was kind of thinking the same thing about the number of cases. I think 10 is good to get your permit, but I think to maintain the permit, like Dr. Lout said, you have to be practicing what you're doing. And I think, you know, to show you're doing 20 cases, you know, per renewal period is appropriate. That's how I was going to verbalize it.
Dr. Brownstein, you.
Well, I apologize, Dr. Hero. I am jumping in here, and I said I wasn't going to do it, but I do think that we need to be clear here that once you achieve a certificate, it's very hard to put requirements after you've achieved that certificate on an individual. What they do with that certificate, whether they practice under that certificate, is really irrelevant to anything that the board has authority over, except in what I do believe you're talking about is from one jurisdiction to another, which you're right, in that situation, it does have relevance. Thank you.
Dr. Brownstein?
Sorry. I accidentally left my hand up from last time. Sorry.
So I'm a little less concerned about 10 or 20 cases and more concerned about can these licensees that are pursuing the certificate actually observe these cases or how do they obtain these cases? And if we need to be more clear on that in our rule writing. Dr. Lout, do you have any thoughts on that?
No, we can always do like we did last time, edit it after hours and bring it back to the committee to see if it's more agreeable and everything. I think if we do it now, it's going to be we're not going to progress very far.
Yeah, I agree with you, and I was going to suggest that. I hate to keep giving you more work after hours, though.
Oh, that's okay.
Dr. Brady.
I was just going to say that it should go to committee as well. I was thinking the same thing. Also, we have I have some language on this, how we handle this, the same very question. And
I think what could also be done then, too, is perhaps we can look at some other state rules and see what caseload they're requiring to make sure there's consistency as well. We don't need to be the lowest, but we also don't necessarily want to be the highest either. But I think it's a great idea to kick it back to the subcommittee to see if we can clarify some of this. Jessica, any questions or can you move us along?
So I do have a question because we're working in subsection, that's the new E now. Initial applicants shall meet one of the following. And I guess I'm a little bit confused because we already have subsection A up here, B. It talks about to obtain or renew a section 1303 permit, a dentist shall, and then all of these things. So I guess my question is, shouldn't the information about initial applicants be up here when we're talking about how they obtain a 1303 permit?
Dr. Snow.
This is the same way all the other sections are written. I don't know that, I mean, it makes sense maybe to put initial before what the other things are, but it's not out of order and it's the way it's been for years. And I think it's been just fine, but if you want to move it, I don't think it's a big deal. The content's there.
Okay.
I agree. When we wrote this, we just wordsmithed it a little bit so it flows better, but the substance is still there, similar to the other sections.
Okay, so that'll bring us then down to, the last question was, could we mimic that 1302 language?
I think we can remove that now. I would just, I was using that for reference in terms of what we were talking about for section 4. I wanted to read it, that's all.
Okay, so subsection O is slightly different. This is talking about what they have to do while they're doing the anesthesia, which is different than what number four was. Number four was saying how to get the permit to do the pediatric anesthesia. This is saying, okay, once you've gotten the permit, this is what you have to do when you're actually performing the procedure.
Dr. Lott.
Yeah, Jessica, I think this is more like what Dr. Caputo had talked about earlier. This is more parental versus enteral. So I kind of agree with Dr. Blasek. I think we can just remove that.
Okay. That will bring us to the new F. Doesn't look like you guys had many changes here.
I have a question. For intraoral permit, do we really need to have two examiners? Just speaking from a point of view of how hard it is to get one, and I would go back to Dr. Caputo and Dr. Loud, who indicated how, you know, really we're talking about intraoral sedation. I think it's a different level of anesthetic, and therefore I think one board examinee on an initial as well as a renewal should be sufficient. And I think you'll help get people certified more quickly.
So as far as it goes right now, we're doing it for the initial, we're doing two, and renewal, we're doing one. And it seems to work pretty well. We're getting more examiners for the oral conscious sedation, the 1303 evaluations. I think it's best to stick with the two. That's just my own preference, my opinion. But I think the one is certainly fine for the renewals.
Dr. Caputo.
Not to take away from the progression of the conversation, but one of the things that the committee could consider, and this has been brought up, and I don't know, I think I saw that Susie was on earlier, and she may want to comment on this as well, but one of the things that comes up for other permits, but as well as I think specifically for this permit level, is if a facility inspection isn't required or not. And so maybe the one of the things that might help when you're considering the evaluation team is if the facility where the person is receiving their permit has been inspected before. Because as long as the facility is within the cycle of the application, then it doesn't need to be evaluated, and that might be able to indicate whether you need one or two examiners. And maybe there's a way you could incorporate that into the language, because that can be helpful from an efficiency standpoint, both for the board and staff, as well as for the person who's looking to get the permit. Thank you.
Susie.
Yes, currently on the 1303, if the office has been evaluated within the last 5 years, then they don't they can just do an oral. And having two evaluators set for an oral exam seems a little excessive to me. And oftentimes the applicant will say, really? They're just asking the questions and there's two of them? And of course, anytime you try, the more people you try to put on a calendar, as we all know, the harder it is to get a date pinned down.
Susie, right now, I think we're just doing one person for an oral evaluation. I think that's what we're doing right now anyway. If the site's business has been within the last 5 years, then we just have one person doing it. That's my understanding anyway.
Yeah, that's not been the case. If it's a new applicant, we have sent two out on an oral eval.
Okay.
Have you noticed delays, Susie, because two are required as opposed to one?
And there's, as I said, there's always some delay when you're trying to work three people's calendars into a date. If it could just be the one evaluator and then the applicant, but when you try to get two evaluators and an applicant, it obviously takes a little more time to get that done generally because you're working with three calendars and they all hold their own calendars and have their own practices.
Any more opinions on if we should have one or two dentists evaluate for the initial?
Dr. Hero?
Yeah.
At the, you know, I don't want to move backwards, but anecdotally, I thought this may be good for the board to understand, the committee to understand a little bit about what the board deals with regarding this permit. There is a current matter in which a applicant has demonstrated that, you know, they've had years of in education, sedation, and anesthesia. They've been teaching it. They've been a very large part of the process in, you know, a very large university system. However, when reviewing the board statutes and rules, an individual like that actually seems to fall through the cracks because they don't meet certain requirements because they have a limited ability to work or a limited permit and ability to work in an education facility. And so I just thought that might be something when the board is considering these sedation permits, that this is one thing that the board is dealing with, and that is you may have education and experience that doesn't meet necessarily the statutes and rules, but it doesn't preclude you from having the prerequisites to do the job and meeting the standard. So I just thought that was something the board, I know it's anecdotal at this point and I don't want to push you backwards, but I thought it was something that everybody should understand based on some certain developments the board is dealing with.
Thank you, Seamus. Well, Jessica, I would say just keep us moving along. I don't think there seems to be strong feeling one way or another on that.
Okay, so I take it there weren't any big changes on this language. Everybody's comfortable with it. I'm still okay with removing subsection C.
Dr. Lau.
Yeah, so that part down there that's highlighted in yellow, that's more of a reminder to myself as much as anything. I just didn't know where to put that. And it's just a reminder that we just need to address it somewhere in the NPR.
Dr. Snow.
Yeah, I just didn't want to pass it. The section just above there, Jessica, there's some light blue lettering that was suggested verbiage that we've taken out before that we need to. So it says moderate sedation via an oral route. That should just be enteral moderate sedation in each of those cases, those three or four that are right there in those next two paragraphs.
Okay.
Dr. Blazek.
Does anyone else have a problem with section A right above there, five section A about mobile permit? And I'll bring this up again. I've mentioned it before because when I'm doing a lot of the general anesthesia evaluations and these doctors are applying for mobile permits and they're rolling into a random office that they don't work at and don't plan to work at, they're not really a mobile provider at all. And, what we're saying to them is, look, as long as you provide an affidavit that says anywhere you go, you're going to verify that the equipment is appropriate and in place. Does anyone else have a problem with that verbiage or with that concept of practice?
Dr. Snell.
Randy, can you, what do you mean have a, I mean, obviously I do mobile travel. So what do you mean having a problem with the verbiage? I'm not understanding.
So what I like is what you do, Heath. You have your own kit. You take it to all your offices and you provide anesthesia in a fashion where you know exactly what it is you have and what you're providing. Dr. Brady, Dr. Brownstein, Ali, I know all you guys. That's how you work. You go from office to office and you have a kit. And therefore, when you walk in and you need something in terms of an emergency item, you know where it's at as well as your anesthesia assistant. What I'm finding with a lot of oral surgeons that are applying for a mobile permit because they're working for PDS or they're working for Aspen Dental or they're working for Valley Oral Surgery, they walk into an office and they have no clue about what's going on in that office because they don't have their kit that they bring in there. They rely on the facility. And I'm having a problem giving them anesthesia permits because I don't believe that the place they're providing care at, even though it's already been approved by another evaluator, is adequately prepared. Certainly the surgeon isn't, not nine times out of ten, because they don't work there. And they walk in without their own equipment. So I'm just wondering if what, not just this section, but any aspect of mobile anesthesia, does it deserve its own subsection? Meaning whether you're providing deep, your general, moderate intravenous or moderate intral, if you're a mobile provider, this is what should follow. And last time I brought it up, I said maybe it's the wrong time to bring it up, but I just don't like the way I'm watching mobile providers, at least in my arena, my field, oral surgeons.
And Dr. Blazek, to your point, I think it was 2 years ago, we had an adverse occurrence in front of us at the board that was an oral surgeon who was running a case at an office that was established with 1301 permit holders other than himself. And, you know, he basically said, you know, I take responsibility, but you know, I didn't check the oxygen and this wasn't working and that wasn't working and I didn't know where this was and, you know, kind of went through this laundry list of an explanation that he wasn't prepared because the facility wasn't really prepared. So it is a good point. I don't know where it fits or what the next step would be, but it's definitely worth flushing out. Dr. Brady.
Yeah. I hear what Randy's saying. I mean, you know, sometimes when you're in this, in an office, I'm speaking out of not doing evaluations for other ones. I haven't done one yet, but, you know, asking an assistant where's such and such and they don't even know where it's at. I mean, that's a concern. And I don't know if it's in the evaluation that, you know, you're asking a list of questions and they have X amount of time to generate a response or appropriateness of this is where my paralytic is, this is what a McGill's is, or however that's evaluated. But, you know, if the staffing, if the permit holder, or the person seeking a permit doesn't have a clue where things are at, they're not a prepared provider, right? And regardless of the facility.
Well, and I know we had talked about looking through the existing packet for evaluators, and maybe this could get addressed within there as opposed to within rule. Dr. Blazek, you have a lot more experience as an evaluator, so I, you know, maybe you can comment to that. And you've got your hand up, so go ahead.
Yeah, I raised my hand because I was going to ask Seamus and Jessica if they had an opinion. Like, I'd love for us to not have it in rule. I would think it'd be great, and we can just put it in the packet. I'm all for that, and then we just self-police. But if Seamus or Jessica have a comment, like, no, this is best under its own section, or if they want us to expand more on what the topic is that we're kind of discussing, you know, to help them understand better what we're just talking about.
I'll defer to Jessica on that if she's comfortable. Jessica, are you comfortable?
I was going to defer to you, Seamus. No, that's okay. So I think what you guys are talking about is, I think what you're talking about is what is required if it's a mobile permit holder and kind of where that regulation comes into play versus the facility having, you know, their own requirements to be a facility versus the mobile permit holder who, if I'm not mistaken, doesn't have those requirements to have all of those things on hand and travel with them. Is that accurate?
I would say, yeah, that's pretty much it. If someone applies for a regular permit, we're examining them and we're examining the facility. So you don't feel one way or the other about, you know, giving the permit or to the provider or the facility. They're one as a whole. Whereas when someone's applying for a mobile, what we're saying is, okay, maybe the facility you're in now isn't equipped, but then you don't get your permit. Oh, but my other facility will be. You know, to us, that shouldn't be the way it is. And it should be, if you're a mobile provider, then that equipment, you can be assured every time is with you more than an affidavit. You're built to be mobile. You have it in a cabinet, what have you. It transports with you.
Jessica.
So, and Ryan, feel free to jump in if you want. But I think that the discussion about mobile permitting is a much larger discussion than just this subset of whether or not they need to have their own equipment that travels with them and their own supplies that travel with them versus relying on the facility. And so I guess my response would be that there's probably a lot more analysis and discussion that needs to happen about mobile permitting. And my gut reaction is if the mobile permit is separate, meaning if it's possible to get a mobile permit and not a regular permit, then I would think that you do want to regulate that and make sure that the mobile permit holder has all of the same things that we're requiring from the facility, has those things with them when they are providing mobile dental services. And I think that that's probably something that needs to be in a rule so that it's enforceable. I don't think that putting it in the permitting guidelines would be enough, particularly if you're then using those guidelines to issue permits. The people who are trying to get the permits need to be aware of what they need to do and what they need to have in order to get their permit and keep their permit.
Dr. Arnell.
Now, this may have already been answered, but in regards to this subject, I hold a mobile permit, and it's already written into the rules and regulations that to have that mobile permit, you have to document that you have everything on the list. They even ask for the serial numbers and so on, and you sign an affidavit that you have it. So I don't think this is something that hasn't already been addressed. As a mobile permit holder, we're already doing this. Every mobile permit holder has to show that they take everything on the list with them and have it with them at all times.
And this is Assistant Attorney General Seamus Monahan. I can echo that is the requirement.
And so usually from a board perspective, it comes down to, whether that factually that equipment was provided. But regardless, it is always a requirement to practice to the standard. So anybody that is required to go out in the purview of a dentist will, you know, or an oral surgeon will then, you know, do those exact same things and document that.
And, you know, as a mobile provider, that has to be shown, to our board examiner and at our renewal. And that was the entire purpose of the 1304, because the CRNA or physician anesthesiologist, is not regulated by the dental board and doesn't have, doesn't go through an exam with the dental board, doesn't have to renew. So when they go to an office, that's why the 1304 was created, is so that it could be shown to the board that when they go to an office, a non-regulated provider, that the equipment would be there.
Ollie.
You know, I think a lot of it to your concern, Dr. Blazek, is, sorry, let me lower my hand. It's yelling at me. What's being regulated, right? Because a couple of years ago, when we were early with this committee, I remember, especially you, Dr. Blazek, were wondering, well, what happens in medicine? From what I understand of it, in medicine, if the physician's office that's doing just sedation, the doctor is regulated by the medical board. If they want to do general anesthetic, then they're having to go to DHS. And so in that regard, at least with general anesthesia, it's the facility that's regulated as opposed to the individual, right? So that oral surgeon that you're saying, that bad actor that's showing up in an office empty-handed to provide, you know, with his mobile permit, that guy who shows up and carries the permit is the one who's responsible for providing a safe anesthetic. You know, so it's, you gotta, I guess, find someone who's doing it and hold them accountable so that others know, well, hey, if I'm being a bad actor, I'm going to be held accountable by my regulatory agency. Other than that, it's their professional obligation and duty to follow the rules as they're outlined and have all of the proper equipment and medication in place. So I guess because I know you've brought it up a couple of times, and I was like, well, how do you fix it other than having the rules clear? And the rules, in my opinion, are pretty clear of what they must have in order to safely do anesthesia. And I don't know what more you can do other than disciplinary action for those that aren't doing it right. Or regulate facilities, but that would mean totally blowing up the whole system instead of regulating the dentist individually.
Well, thank you guys for the input. You're obviously identifying what my concerns. And I do agree. It's just some bad actors, I think, out there that I'm having trouble. They're taking advantage of the mobile permit is what they're doing. They're not at all utilizing it, what you're using it for, Dr. Arnell or, Ali or, you know, Dr. Brown. They're not at all utilizing it in that same way. They're literally guns for hire. And it happens pretty much only with oral surgeons, and they just go from place to place and they just show up and do anesthesia and, you know, what have you. I worry about that. Not a safe model.
Well, and Dr. Blazek, you had written in the comment section about talking off hours in a subcommittee. You know, I think that's a good idea, and then maybe presenting something back to this committee.
That'd be great. And then, when we do those types of things, Dr. Hero, do we have opportunity to kind of bounce things off of Jessica, like by email?
Yeah, I mean, Ryan, why don't you answer that? But yeah, I would think certainly Ryan and Seamus would be available. I don't want to speak for Jessica, but okay. Ryan, why don't you answer that, or Jessica certainly can.
So, and maybe Jessica's better to answer, but from my perspective, Jessica's probably not going to, well, and from my perspective, really, we as a board, the board currently is paying for Jessica's services to be at these meetings and other meetings to help us in the writing of all of these provisions, but I don't want to pay for her to sit in like Dr. Lau, and I'm not sure who you saw with Dr. Lau, probably German. We don't want her to sit in those to come up with language, but what we really want to see is the two people that are collaborating, if there's a collaboration outside of here, to come up with something that those two people agree on, send it to staff. We'll forward it to Jessica. Jessica then incorporates it like she did Dr. Lau and Dr. German, I'm assuming was the one.
Dr. Still.
Project. And then when we all meet together, that's when you guys have an opportunity to discuss what the two collaborators presented to this group. And Jessica.
I to
sit in those either. Go ahead, Shane.
And this is Seamus. I would just encourage anybody that has any questions to direct those questions through Ryan, as he just discussed. Nobody should have any direct contact with Jessica outside of the committee's directions.
And Dr. Blazek, if you're identifying this as mainly an oral surgeon issue, then I think you and Dr. Christensen, I mean, it would make a lot of sense for you guys to discuss it. I'm happy to be there as well if you just want, some perspective from adverse occurrences I've dealt with on the board. Dr. Christensen's obviously on the board as well. But, if you feel a need for me as well, I can make myself available for you guys. Dr. Snow.
I was just going to say the same thing. Since it's a mobile deal, I obviously am not a neurosurgeon, nor do I do 1301, but if you want a mobile perspective, Randy, I'd be happy to help out, but I don't need to. So.
Okay, Jessica. You can keep us moving along.
Okay, so I think we left off here, the highlighted language, which I believe was a note to make sure that we had this substance in our rules somewhere, but that maybe this was not the best place for it. So if you guys want to discuss the substance of it, then we can figure out where to put it later.
Okay. I would like to maybe change the verbiage on that just a little bit. After the word expectorates, I would put the sedative medications. Or just singular medication.
And then I would say put comma, or I just leave the semicolon there, and do not administer additional dose.
And I think we can put that in the section that we talked before of enteral moderate sedation, talking about the 1.5 times. That might be under the minimal sedation, come to think of it. Can I make one other recommendation?
Please do.
I would say in pediatric patients, if the pediatric patient expectorates his medication or the medication, do not administer additional dose. And I would probably take out less than 8 years of age. I would just make it the pediatric patient. Because I think this is more applicable to children in general.
Do we have pediatric patient defined?
That's good question.
I don't believe we have it defined yet, but I think that is one of the things that we considered. And if that's the case, then we can we've sort of defined it here in pediatric endorsement. means giving sedation or anesthesia to a pediatric patient who is younger than 8 years of age.
So this is kind of tricky. I think the same kind of applies to like a patient that's 8 to 12. So I'm not for sure how we can rephrase this.
Yeah, and just because, so my concern would be that in most of the rules where we're talking about pediatric patients, we're talking about pediatric patients who are younger than 8 years
correct
of age, but there correct are also situations where you have pediatric patients who are pediatric patients, but they are older than 8 years of age.
Right.
And so I wouldn't want to create a definition that minces the two.
And to that point, Jessica, from the state's point, it would be difficult to prosecute a case in which we didn't or had two different defining standards of what is pediatric care.
Right. So I lean towards not defining pediatric patient and instead mentioning, you know, a pediatric patient less than 8 years of age. I know it's more wordy, but I think it's more accurate.
Can that age be increased? I think that was Dr. Lout's concern.
So like less than 12 years of age? Just for that one section.
From a legal standpoint, from a state standpoint, yes. State would just need, the board would just need to make a determination factually on the record each time why the age different is different from the 8 year old and why so and how it correlates.
Dr. Blazing.
I was going to mention Dr. Caputo had his hand raised before me.
Oh, I'm sorry. Dr. Caputo, go ahead.
I don't know that it can happen right now, but I think what Dr. Lout's trying to accomplish is effectively not redosing in the event that a dose that's administered is not ingested. It might be worthwhile just to put a hold on that and maybe try to work on some language and enter that into the rule, and then you don't have to worry about any kind of age indication or otherwise. You just indicate something to the effect of another dose cannot be administered if the first dose is not appropriately ingested, something to that effect. But I think that's really what the goal of this comment is, other than really an age-related thing, unless I misinterpreted his comment.
No, that's pretty much the same.
Yeah, and I would agree, but with that summation. But I'm looking at the definitions, and I see we have pediatric endorsement defined, but I don't see where we give a definition of pediatric patients, or am I missing it?
I don't think we have one, Randy.
We don't?
No, I looked when we were preparing a lot of the pediatric stuff. I don't think we have one for a pediatric patient. We have one for the sedation less than 8 years of age, but we don't have one as a pediatric patient in general.
So I would read that, again, I defer to Jessica and Seamus, that if you just put pediatric in there, then we all know, you know, and anyone giving those oral sedations, like Dr. Caputo said, the aim is not to be redosed. And I think that that's appropriate.
This is Jessica. Is this only a concern? Is the redosing only a concern in pediatric patients? Or is it a concern and something you want to regulate in all patients?
No, as far as I know, it's pediatric patients, because our guidelines say you should not redose. The American Academy of Pediatric Dentists, a couple of our documents or guidelines do not recommend that.
And pediatric patients in that sense would be any patient who is less than 18 years of age?
Well, I guess it could be. This might be something that we address as the subcommittee and maybe bring it back to the group.
And again, you know, just to drive it home. And this is what local community considers the standard of care.
I'm sorry, what's that again, Seamus? Does the committee, the subcommittees, consider the standard of care?
The local
community. Yeah, the minimum standard of care in these situations.
I think we do.
And I only say that for the fact that, you know, if these cases ever do go to, you know, to the board for adjudication or hearing, that we'll be able to identify.
Okay.
And prove that matter.
Yeah, I'll take a look at our guidelines and then I'll bring it back to the committee. I'll read it a little finer print.
Seamus or Jessica, is it problematic if a definition for the pediatric patient is created and the age is different than what the pediatric endorsement age is?
Would you like to handle that, Jessica?
I was going to let Seamus go first, but I do think it is problematic, and I think, and Seamus, stop me if I'm wrong, but I think part of the issue is that pediatric in its common usage has a very defined term, and it's basically anyone who is under the legal age. And so when you're using pediatric patient, it would be anyone who's under 18 in the normal usage of the word. If you're using that word pediatric in a different sense, then you would want to define it. Now, in this case, I don't think it's beneficial to define it because you do have situations where you have pediatric patients who are older than 8, but younger than 18. And that would still be considered in normal usage.
I would agree.
But then
so you're just saying stick with the pediatric, okay. Just put a pediatric patient.
If you're looking to regulate the double dosing of a patient who is younger than 18, then yes.
Okay.
Use pediatric patients.
Okay.
If you're looking for all patients, then just use patients. If you're looking for a pediatric patient who is less than 8, then you would want to say pediatric patient 8 years or less.
Okay. So I guess for this sentence, I would just leave it a pediatric patient.
Okay.
And I have no comments on that. But okay. But I would like to comment that Jessica is typing with the speed of a hyena, and I appreciate that.
Thank you, Shane.
So I guess we can maybe consider putting this sentence in the area of the 1.5 times under minimal sedation.
What if this is Blazik. What if we thought about making a definition for redosing? And you talk about that in there and you define redosing to the pediatric patient. Is that a possibility?
Yeah, I think our committee can kind of put something together for that.
Jessica?
So this is probably splitting hairs, but part of what I do is look at every nuance of each word that you're using in your rule. And I'm wondering if really what we're trying to get at is if the medication is not ingested, which is different than if the patient expectorates. Right, there are other ways that the medication may not be ingested other than expectorating. And so I'm wondering if we should reword this to, and maybe that goes more towards, was it Dr. Blazik who mentioned maybe we consider something about redosing and defining that?
Well, you know, maybe the subcommittee can work on this. I think we're kind of going round and round right now. And
we'll also find a place where to put it.
Yeah. Why don't we move along, Jessica? Let the subcommittee flush it out and then we can revisit it.
All right. That brings us to tonsil size, which is highlighted.
Dr. Blazik.
I just would ask or I'm curious, on most of the anesthetic records for an enteral sedation, don't they have a section for like ASA and Mallampati and things like that? And that would be indicated in that section, wouldn't it be?
Yes.
I mean, Thompson's Slice is specific, but yeah.
I know we have it on ours, and I think most people do.
So, and I would defer again to some of the anesthesia providers that have more training than me, such as the dental anesthesiologist or Dr. Germain. I mean, would it be appropriate in this section to indicate that the anesthetic record should indicate the ASA status, the Mallampati status, other than if, like you have here, if the patient's behavioral or emotional state prevents this evaluation? You know, 'cause I can understand that might be a problem too.
So you're saying add the ASA classification?
Yeah, I would say that much like in the 1301 and 1302, you have, you say, you know, the following entries would be, you know, preoperative, intraoperative, postoperative, pulse ox, and ASA Mallampati. That would all be on your anesthetic record. As opposed to, you don't need a special note. I mean, that's part of the anesthetic record. You verify NPO status, you verify last intake of food, and you verify ASA and Mallampati. So wherever that is in the O2, it's in the same section, you know, we word it the same. As opposed to special notes, you just put down what we have in those other sections.
So you're just recommending putting what we have in 1302 right there.
Yep, as far as ASA, Mallampati, and NPO status.
Okay, I'm comfortable with that.
So if I'm looking for near 1302 language, what am I looking for?
So in 1302, we have here, I'm reading it right now.
It's 1302G.
Thank you.
And there isn't any verbiage, neither is it in 1301 for Mallampati or ASA or anything else.
Oh, really? Oh, it's in our exam bundle. When we go do the exam, it says that their anesthetic record indicates these items. Maybe we should just leave it out and put it in the evaluation portion. So strike that totally and just leave it in the evaluation. Because I certainly identify what you're trying to intend, Dr. Lau, which is, hey, if you have a patient with a bad airway, even if you're just giving oral sedation, that bad airway becomes a real problem really fast. Right.
Exactly.
And you're trying to say, hey, let's be aware of that, and let's make sure you take a look at that patient's, you know, airway before you decide to give them that dose of medication. And usually when a child is crying, it's very easy to see back there.
That's correct.
Jessica.
So kind of to emphasize rule structure and what Seamus had mentioned about minimal requirements. When we're talking about special notes, this seems to be more of a suggestion, the way that it's written, special notes such as nothing by mouth or last intake of food or water, tonsil size. So are these things that are necessary? Do they need to be in the anesthesia or sedation record?
They do.
Okay. So then I would suggest at the very least removing such as and switching it to include.
Yeah, that's fine. Dr. Blasek, would you consider including ASA classification here?
You know, now that, you know, I'm reading it now, that Heath brought it up. I think you keep it in the evaluation form.
Okay.
And you leave it out of here. Yeah. And if we're consistent, it just says nothing by mouth, time of last intake of food or water, and consent form. That's what's in the 01 permit. Everything else is the same. That you have intraoperative and postoperative pulse ox, intraop, postop blood pressures. Of course, a 1301, we include some other items, which I don't think you need, in this section.
Jessica.
Okay, so one of the things that we're going to require are special notes, including nothing by mouth or last intake of food or water. So not both, correct?
I think it should be both. Nothing by mouth. And don't you make your patients NPO before you give them an oral sedation?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Dr. Caputo.
Or should be in hand.
I think her point is, which I would agree with, it's the same thing. If your note says the last intake of food or water, which actually is probably better, that is your indicator. To say nothing by mouth, it the way it's worded here is pretty broad, even though we understand what that means. But to say last intake of food or water, then you can comport that with whatever your requirements are, whether it's 6 hours, 8 hours, 2 hours, whatever rule you're following. But if you're going to say nothing by mouth, I think you should qualify that. And so I think you achieve the same thing if you just have in there last intake of food or water. Thank you.
Jessica.
This again may be splitting hairs, but should it also include any medications taken by mouth? So if they took Tylenol or something before the visit, does that matter?
It would matter for the record, but it wouldn't necessarily preclude you from doing the procedure. You know, like in general anesthetic, a lot of times we will give the patient something preoperatively, such as an antibiotic, or sometimes even an oral sedative, and then they come in and we put them to sleep. But I don't know if it needs to be included. So I guess I'm trying to answer your question, but I'm not really leaning that it needs to be included in a special note.
Dr. Brady.
It seems like it's getting really into the details with this, and I get it, but it almost seems like it's just a part of what the community does, right? So isn't this just standard of care that we're getting into, that you can still hold someone accountable for not upholding standard of care instead of trying to tease out all the details?
I tend to agree with that.
And maybe it would help to just address what that standard is again. And the standard in this community is what a reasonable dentist would do in a like situation in this locale, if that helps.
So what I'm hearing is...
Dr. Brady.
Yeah, I just wanted to kind of put that question back onto our peeps out there that are helping with this. I mean, I think that's because we're talking about that. I mean, would you guys agree with that, or how would you change that to reflect it where it's just a standard of care for these special notes? Or does it even need to be there to begin with?
Dr. Blazing.
According to what Seamus said, you know, what's the standard care? And I think the intent that we are all well aware of is that when you put someone to sleep intravenously or orally, you don't eat or drink anything for, you know, 6 hours prior to surgery, maybe water at 4 hours. But that's a standard of care I think that we all would know and follow pretty routinely, I would imagine the intent of the statutes is to reemphasize that. I mean, for someone to put someone to sleep on an elective case outside those parameters anywhere would be considered inappropriate. So I guess that these special notes are just documentation that you verified that the patient didn't eat or drink anything for the previous 6 hours.
Jessica.
So I'm wondering, instead of saying special notes, if you just say the last, document the last intake of food or water and leave it at that.
I agree with that.
And do you need sample size?
I think you do. I would say document documentation including last intake of food or water, tonsil size. And the reason I say that, I do a lot of these sedation evaluations on dentists that do adults, and they don't look at tonsil size. I know it's more critical on kids than it is adults, but you know, I think that's something that should be looked at. That's often not looked at.
Dr. Caputo.
I guess in light of how you changed it, I think going back to Dr. Blazek's point, then I think you just put ASA status as well in this.
Dr. Blazek.
You know, it is funny how, you know, I just assumed that that was in our statute about ASA and Mallampati because I do so many evaluations and that is part of the evaluation record, you know. And I know it's been brought up before about making the statutes not quite so specific so that we have the opportunity to modify the evaluation aspect kind of on the fly. I guess my comment here is just more point of reference as opposed to any recommendations.
Ali.
Just a comment on the requirement to document tonsil size. I mean, are you saying, what if we say airway evaluation, right? Because there's a lot of different ways to document an airway evaluation. I can say the only time I've ever noted specifically tonsil size is if I notice that they were very, very large. If they were fine, I wouldn't chart it. You know, Mallampati is probably the most common, but it also isn't the only way. I mean, I would just recommend saying instead of tonsil size, I would say airway evaluation. Because there's a lot of ways that you can document assessment of an airway.
Jessica.
For what it's worth, I think that that's a great idea to put in evaluation of airway, because what that's going to do is it's going to require the dentist to document how they've evaluated the airway for the patient. And at that point, if there is an issue and it goes up to the board can then look at the type of evaluation that the dentist did and whether that was appropriate for the procedure and the patient that they were treating.
And Jessica, if you don't mind me stating, just to piggyback on that point, if you are identifying any issue or any practice aspect, you know, the best thing is to always go as vague as possible, because if you can't, you know, the issue is trying to identify everything. So if you could identify every single thing that is required in a record as the standard of care, then that's great. And I can go in there. Unfortunately, I think that amongst even members of the committee, that would change. And so the ability for the committee to be a little more vague to allow the board to develop those standards factually under each situation with bumpers would really be helpful. And I apologize, Jessica, if I stepped on your toes.
Not at all.
Dr. Lowe.
So if everybody else is comfortable with that, I'm comfortable with evaluation of airway instead of tonsil size.
I left G as a list of patients intake, last intake of food or water, and then I added in a new H, evaluation of the patient's airway, and then we have I, which is time of discharge and status, including name of escort.
Jessica, I think we'd consider taking nothing by mouth out and just going with last intake of food or water.
There we go.
That's what she has there, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. It is. That just crossed it out.
Okay. Any other comments or discussion on this section, or should we move on?
I think you can move us along, Jessica.
Okay. Brings us to F, which I think is just, and this correct me if I'm wrong, enteral water sedation here. Well, that brings us to H. Section 1303, permit holder may employ or work with an anesthesia or sedation provider that qualifies under 1304B5 to provide anesthesia or sedation services with the limitations outlined in 1304A and shall ensure that the healthcare professional continuously supervises the patient from the administration of anesthesia or sedation until termination of the anesthesia or sedation procedure and oxygenation, ventilation, and circulation are stable if all of the following conditions are met. And then we've removed number one, leaves us with number two. The section 1303 permit holder has completed coursework within the 2 years prior to submitting the permit application in one or more of the following: ACLS from the American Heart Association, or another agency that follows the same procedures, standards, and techniques for training as the American Heart Association, HALS, in the practice treating patients less than 8 years of age. Now, I have a question here. What if the patient is 9? Do you still want to require PALS?
The way the section reads is one or more of the following. So as long as they just have ACLS, they're okay. Or if they have PALS, they're okay. That's the way I read that.
I think we should actually pull the PALS one out so that they have to have A, or what would become B, but is C.
Yeah.
And then in the practice treating pediatric patients, they must have PALS.
That sounds good, actually.
Okay, and again, is that going to be any pediatric patient or a pediatric patient less than 8 years of age?
That would be any pediatric patient.
Well, I think PALS is for less than 12, right?
I think it is, but
if you're saying legally pediatric is under 18, you don't need PALS to a 16-year-old.
Well, but then we have to go back to changing the different ages for everything. So right. I'd probably just leave it at PALS as in a practice treating pediatric patients.
Dr. Brady, then Dr. Blazek.
Quite honestly, I think PALS for the pediatric endorsement, being less than 8 years old, when you're capturing that audience above 8, they're approaching the max dose into adult dose into ACLS anyway, and ACLS is where they're going to get a lot of that educational value for rescue. PALS go into a lot of things like sepsis and other tangents, so I'm fine with just having that in the PEDS endorsement section.
Dr. Blazek.
What I was going to mention is I really do like having, you know, two providers that are PALS trained in the O1 and the O2 permits. I just don't know if we really need that in the O3 if you're hiring an anesthesia or a sedation provider. That's my opinion on it. I think if you're hiring a CRNA or a dental anesthesiologist or a medical anesthesiologist who already have their PALS certification with an enteral component, I think you're fine. But if you are the dentist providing the oral sedation, then you should have PALS.
So I think to go back to that, Jessica, we want PALS in a practice treating patients less than 8 years of age. That's kind of what you're saying, Jason, correct?
Yes, that is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Jason, do you think you need two providers there if you're doing an oral sedation on somebody? Both providers need to be trained.
If utilizing this section allows for a general anesthetic, if you're bringing in a physician anesthesiologist or a CRNA.
Wait, for the 1303 permit?
Right, that's what this section's saying, is that a 1303 permit can bring in a physician anesthesiologist or a CRNA and go up to the level of a 1301 in a general anesthetic.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Yeah, so we're opening up a whole can of worms here. Yeah, there's probably going to be a lot of discussion surrounding that too. And I hate to be the one to break the ice. I do have to leave at 4:30. I hope that doesn't break a quorum.
No, I think we're okay.
I'm going to have to look at this a little bit. I'm going to have to look at that a little bit more in depth.
I'm hoping we get to the start of the 1304 and then, you know, we can at the next meeting launch off there. But we're okay, Jason, with you leaving.
Okay.
From a quorum.
You know, from where we,
all right, thank you,
where we go with the 1304 talk could change some of the 1304 references in 3, 2, and 1.
Yeah, that's a good point.
That's what I'm thinking too. That's why I was like, I'm going to have to kind of like circle back to this section.
So Jessica, maybe we can just kind of move on. Try to finish up I and then wrap the meeting up and come back to this as we discuss the 1304 permit.
Okay. I'm just going to make a note. German had a question. What are the guidelines for discharge? None are listed in the document.
What did we do with 1301 and 1302 when it comes to guidelines for discharge?
If I recall correctly, we said that they had to have documented standards for discharge.
Yeah, we were vague on precisely defining them. But we said they had to have a documented guideline.
Well, I would think we would just duplicate that here, right?
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Because there's different ways to do that. I remember our last discussion of 1301 and 1302. This reads well.
that brings us down to minimal sedation staffing requirements.
Yeah, this was put in there real early in the game. Dr. Germain had done that, and I think we've kind of changed a lot of this as we've gone through, and that's why we kind of crossed it out.
I would agree. I think that this has already been covered in the pediatric language.
Right. We have.
I agree too. Yep.
Okay. That brings us to 1304.
Dr. Brady.
Hey, I know we're probably going to be talking about this in the next meeting, but I just wanted to make a couple of comments as we're getting into the 1304 for just this committee to think about in general. And I think Ali did a great job trying to get a 1305 in place that addressed some of these concerns. But now that the 1305 permitting our non-permitted anesthesia providers is not going to be within this discussion, I think it's very important for us to kind of understand these questions that I'm going to have and that maybe Ali can get in front of to help revise the 1304 permit so that we can have this like open discussion about mitigating a lot of the concerns that I have personally for the 1304 permit. So I thought it'd be nice to just post it here for everyone to just read it to know at least where I'm coming from with this. And I think, let me just go ahead and put this here. And I know at one time we had this in subcommittee, you know, if we want to go about doing some work with this on subcommittee, I'm fine with that too.
Ryan, you got your hand up. You want to talk while they're posting that?
Yeah. So, and actually, I've been regretting this moment, or not regretting, but worried about this moment for a while, but anticipating that I'm going to get some pushback quite a bit. But this board, I'm a non-provider of any kind. I barely provide for my family food on the table, so take that with that perspective. So this board, and Sherry, jump in and correct me if I'm wrong, did not even used to have a 1304 permit until I think 2012. And then there was some issue that came into play about the reasoning why we needed it. This committee's even discussed about having like some collaborative statutory reform with the nursing board and the medical board so that this board can regulate two other professions, which this, your assistant attorney general, not this current one, but I'm sure after I'm done, he'll probably agree. This board can never regulate another profession, regardless of how much you work together or collaborate to come up with some sort of statutory reference. And I'll just cut to the chase. I am not a fan of the 1304 permit or the language in 1304 as it exists today, nor am I a fan of any of the other new language. I'm not completely a non-fan of it. I just don't think that this board needs to get involved in regulating other professions in any form or fashion. And I think that that was what the attempt was by introducing the 1304. And if I can just quote Dr. Caputo, which I wouldn't say is Socrates, but he's pretty close. I think we're trying too hard as a committee to establish something or establish some sort of baseline or guideline or threshold or whatever we want to call it to protect the public more. And I think there's three professions, medical, that are regulated, medical professionals, dental professionals, and nursing professionals. And I think if an issue comes in with a dentist's office with the treatment of a patient by the dentist, this board should regulate that. But if there's an issue regarding anesthesia and it wasn't provided by a dentist, then the nursing board or the medical board should regulate that portion. even if it occurred in a dental practice. And so this board, I think the committee is trying too hard. And what we're doing, then we're introducing many more references and many other rules that make it that much more challenging for any case to come in and be, go to a hearing and actually be argued on behalf of the board or the state at this point, that there would be any way that the board would prevail. And with that, I will shut up. And I know Dr. Caputo, who I called Socrates, may want to jump in and probably the guy.
Ali, why don't you go ahead?
Thanks. Ryan, thank you for what you said. I pretty much agree with all of it. I did want to give a little for anybody that didn't get a chance after our last meeting in anticipation of talking about this section that has just became just a mess of red. this section got to where it looks in this packet, basically from Dr. Brady, Dr. Blazek, Dr. Snell, Dr. German, and others trying to figure out a solution that could work to solve a problem. And the language that's in here now, and there's an email that I sent to Dr. Hero and to Ryan, kind of basically requesting to redact almost all of my recommendations, because there's like two or three different strategies of accomplishing this that somehow all ended up still in this section in red. So it's really, really super confusing. And it was already confusing enough with each of them on their own. So I requested basically like pull this all out. And I think that's kind of where Ryan's coming from and talking about, you know, after the Attorney General's office came in and told us, you know, you guys can't do these things that you're trying to do. It kind of put us all like, wow, well, we worked on this for 2 years to try and find a solution. And I think it kind of got to the point of, well, in this committee, we're probably not going to be able to find a solution. So that's all I have to say, is just to give a little of that information. And that email, if anybody's curious what I wrote, is, I think, at the bottom of this packet.
Thank you, Ali. Jessica.
So I'm thinking that the only reason for this 1304 permit is to allow the dentist who doesn't have a 1301, 1302, or 1303 permit to still employ or work with an anesthesia or sedation provider, because they cannot be the sedation or anesthesia provider themselves because they're not permitted under 1301, 1302, or 1303. So I somewhat agree with Ryan that I don't know that this is necessary, because you're not regulating the nurses. You're not regulating the physicians. You're only regulating the dentist. But I guess my question is there a need to regulate the dentist in this situation? Because otherwise they can get a 1301 permit. They can get a 1302 or a 1303 if they want to work with the provider themselves.
But, and Jessica, if I could just comment on that, if they don't bring in an individual who meets the requirements for 1304, then it doesn't apply. And so they are subject to discipline no matter what, regardless of the 1304 permit.
I was going to say for context, that's the way it was before 2012. If a general dentist or a periodontist or whomever wanted to employ a non-dentist anesthesia provider, that dentist had to have the permit. So if he was going to do general anesthesia, he had to have a 1301. If he was going to do moderate sedation, he had to have a 1302. And in many states, that is still how it is. I know for a fact that's how it is in California. And that's what allowed, or what I think we thought allowed the board to have oversight over what kind of anesthesia was being provided in the dental office.
Dr. Caputo.
So to provide a little context, to everybody on the history of our permits in the state. What we originally had was called a 1301 educationally qualified or a 1301 non-educationally qualified permit. And those dentists that were interested in working with a non-dentist or did not have the training to provide sedation or anesthesia, they could apply for a 1301 non-educationally qualified permit. That had its own issues and challenges. And so back when we last revised these rules, we changed that 1301 non-educationally qualified to a 1304. So that was the evolution to the current language and permitting. And understanding everything that's been said, and to sort of echo what Brian said earlier, you know, this idea of regulation of practitioners who are outside of dentistry is a conundrum, obviously, and we've dealt with this already. So really the choices here are one of two. The first one that I think is the one that's perplexing for most of us is, what's the responsibility of the dentist? And one of the things that I think is a concern is that oftentimes non-permitted dentists are given a misleading presentation that the person coming into their office is going to be wholly responsible for any administration of sedation or anesthesia, and anything that were to happen to the patient would not be of any of their responsibility. And ultimately, that's just not true. And I think that is missed somewhere along the way, particularly when there is a complaint secondary to a bad outcome or adversity, that the dentist is responsible for the treatment that's provided in their practice, regardless of what the other provider says to them, and whether they're licensed, permitted, or otherwise within dentistry. And the question then becomes, do you let that exist as it is, or do you do as some other states have done and put some regulation into what dentists can and cannot do? And effectively what other states have done when addressing this is that if you're going to work with a non-dentist provider for the administration of sedation or anesthesia, that dentist needs a permit. And that dentist needs either a moderate sedation permit or a deep sedation general anesthesia permit. And if they're going to work with a non-dentist practitioner, that person can only provide sedation or anesthesia to the training and or permit level of that dentist. And that's been a pathway that multiple states have followed here, is that if you're going to do sedation or anesthesia in your office, you follow a permitting process as directed by the board for dentists. And then if you're going to bring in another person who's not regulated or licensed by that dental board, this is what they can do based on that permitted dentist. So those are sort of the options for this current committee to consider and discuss, is not whether it's a CRNA or a physician or anything like that, is what do you want the requirement of the dentist to be, and how are you going to address that? Thank you.
Thank you, Dr.
Hero. Can I just add to that real quickly? And the other aspect of that, which is absolutely right, you know, is the, again, the qualifications and the, it's kind of a negligent hiring situation, if that makes it clearer. It depends on the person employing that person to ensure that they're employing somebody who is also, or referring somebody who is also able to do the job appropriately. And that is one thing that the board always takes into consideration.
And Seamus, that kind of touches on what my concern has been, particularly over the last few years on the board. You know, our counterparts in medicine are very different in that they're not doing general anesthesia in an office-based setting. is happening in ASCs or hospitals where the providers are vetted and the facility is being overseen by DHS. The difficulty and the concern for public safety that occurs in a dental office when you have a dentist working with a non-dentist anesthesia provider is there's no real requirement for that CRNA or MD to be vetted. I mean, and then the board has no regulation over that. And it just adds to the difficulty of the board's task of ensuring public safety. So I know we all know that, but I think it's something that we have to keep in the forefront of our minds as we're talking through this permit. Dr. Arnell, why don't you go and then Ali.
Thank you. I just wanted to echo, I guess I wanted to comment and say, trying to solve the vast array of problems with the 1304 permit, you know, it was attempted and it's really not solved any problems at all. It's been a very complicated issue. The solution that has been found in many states, as Anthony stated, is that the non-permitted provider provides sedation and anesthesia to the level of the dentist that they're working with. And I think that's a time-tested model. It's a model that provides protection for the dental profession, for the dental board, for the patients, and for the anesthesia provider brought in. It really is the simplest path to the goal. And I would say we would be wise to look at the time-tested, proven conclusion that many dental boards have come to. And actually our own dental board came to back in 2012 and 13 before it was taken for revision. That was the conclusion that they came to, and then at the last moment it was changed to a 1304. I just wanted to say I agree wholeheartedly with what Anthony said. It should be changed to the model of providing to the level of the dentist. Thank you very much.
Ollie.
I have a question that Seamus might be able to help answer. You know, when looking at the 1304 permit, one of the issues that was taken up was that it's, even though, you know, it's requiring the dentist to have the permit, it's the dental board saying that in order for a non-dentist provider to come in, that the dentist needs to get a permit and indirectly ends up regulating or restricting the practice of physicians and CRNAs who have statutory authority to work in dental offices. So what I'm hearing from Dr. Caputo and Dr. Arnall is to take it even a step further and say now a qualified provider, being a physician anesthesiologist or CRNA, can only work to the level of the dentist. And I know that there's other states that have that in place, but it seems to me that may be further regulating non-dentists.
Thank you for that question. I think that's a great question. And at the risk of, you know, really getting too much into it, you know, I think that as a threshold issue, you know, this kind of addresses FTC concerns about, you know, the board, again, attempting to regulate not only other professions, but professions that can perform the duties we're talking about without being licensed. And so I do think that's one thing to consider, because it is a big consideration here. The other thing is that, you know, legally, from a legal standpoint, you know, whether it's stated in the rule or not, it's irrelevant if you have a 1304 permit if you go out and hire somebody who has no clue what they're doing and you didn't vet them. And so I think that's another aspect that the committee has discussed, that they should discuss more, because that is really the crux of
you know, the rule here and being able to prosecute it is it's put in place, and whether you agree with it or not, it is put in place for the purpose right now of ensuring that that individual brings in a qualified individual. So again, there is no purpose to the rule, which you do have, and if you want to appeal it, that's fine, but while you have it, you have to give life to it. And the life says, you know, that if you're going to bring an individual in under your 1304 permit, you should vet that individual. Now, if an adverse occurrence happens or a, you know, unprofessional conduct situation happens with that individual providing those services, that doesn't always mean, as we've seen, that the providing dentist is responsible for it. But it still comes back on them to ensure that they are bringing in a qualified individual. Thank you. I'm sorry, does that help?
Yeah.
I could elaborate, but I'd like to let you guys do your thing.
Jessica, you want to go ahead?
Sure. And so this is kind of, I guess, maybe piggybacking a little bit on what Seamus was saying. And that's why I have this section here highlighted. I made this change because what this rule is initially saying is it's talking about the physician anesthesiologist or CNRA. And I think that's where you're starting to get into some issues about, you know, whether you're regulating or attempting to regulate someone who you shouldn't be regulating. And really what we're saying, and I think what Seamus pointed out, was that the onus needs to be on the dentist. You're regulating the dentist. The dentist is the one who you are saying may or may not employ or work with one of these other anesthesia or sedation providers. And in order to do that, here are the requirements that the dentist has to meet. The dentist has to ensure that whoever they're hiring meets the standards for, you know, providing anesthesia or sedation in the dental setting. And it's the dentist who has to make sure that, you know, the anesthesiologist or the sedation provider doesn't leave immediately after administering the anesthesia. And so there's certain things that are the onus of the dentist, even if it's not the dentist administering the anesthesia. And I think if you're going to keep a 1304 permit, then that's kind of the direction that the rule should take, so that you're making it clear that you're regulating the dentist and what the dentist may do versus trying to identify what the third party sedation provider may do, if that makes sense.
Dr. Brady.
Thank you. Yeah, and kind of to address that point a little bit as well, it's the same evolution that happened with Mississippi when I first started this discussion, when we first started meeting, was trying to get an avenue to be able to permit non-permitted anesthesia providers. And we were able to work up to a point, and then it changed. And then we went back to doing the same suggestion has been there to having either a 1301 permit and doing the regulations on the dentist. That regulation was codified. It was challenged by the Advanced Nursing Board, and they took it all the way up to the state Supreme Court, and the dental board actually challenged it and still won the case. And it's in their purview just to regulate the dentist. And so I'm hopeful that this 1304, we can find language to find a place that works, with those addressed questions that I've posted. So thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Brady. Well, you know, as we're getting close to five, I think, let's start to wrap this up. So I'm going to jump to agenda item six, the committee meeting dates. Have you guys had a chance to look at those and any objections? If not, then I think we move to adjournment.
Second. Second that.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed?
Aye.
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 Motion carries, none opposed. Thank you, everybody. Really appreciate everyone's help behind the scenes in the subcommittee meetings. We won't see you till next year, so Merry Christmas, Happy Holidays, and look forward to seeing you guys after the beginning of the year.
Thank you.
Merry Christmas, everybody. Great job. Merry Christmas.